This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Outlandish. Thank you very much, Mahmoud Ibrahim, for that. It is 41 degrees in New York. Nice day outside, going up to a high of 43. And hey, peace. Coming up next, Ecologic with David O. Cuto. Please stay tuned.
You don't know what you've got until you lose it. You don't know what you've got until you lose it. You don't know what you got until you lose it. Baby, 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 give me one more chance. You gave me the world, threw it away. You know the real I want. You come every day. Baby, 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 give me one more chance. Well, you gave me the world, but I threw it away. You real I want. Don't come every day. So, baby, 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 give me one more chance.
Welcome to the broadcast. My name is David Ocuto, and you are tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. And today we will be approaching the issues from the standpoint of children, the nature of childhood, the rights of the child. Law reflects a movement from a view of children as property to a view of children as a protected underclass. And as we continue to evolve socially and personally, to a view of children as rights-based citizens. What is the culture that underpins this social and personal evolution for an understanding of the rights of the child and the nature of childhood? Please stay tuned. I will be in conversation with Elizabeth Goodenough, scholar and activist in the emerging field of children's studies. Thank you for listening, and be back in a moment. The music of Vivaldi, Cello Concerto in D, from the early 18th century, written in Venice by the master Vivaldi. And that is on the liner notes. I love this phrase. This music represents the deathless legacy of unbounded inspiration and imperishable freshness. The music of Vivaldi, performed by Antonio Gianegro, the cellist, recorded in 1960. You are tuned to WBAI New York. My name is David Occhiuto, and I am joined at the moment by Elizabeth Goodenough. Elizabeth is a scholar and activist in the emerging field of children's studies. Elizabeth has taught English and American literature since 1976 at Harvard University, Claremont McKenna College, and the University of Michigan. Elizabeth Goodenough, thank you for joining me today.
David, thank you so much for asking me to be on your program.
Great. It's so nice to have you. Elizabeth, before we get to your work with children's issues in terms of the day-to-day life and the advocacy work around children's lives on issues of rules and agendas and the work to bring play and freedom back into the life of the child, you have a recent work that I'd like to touch on at the moment, because right now we're so embroiled in the issues around devastation and war. You have a book recently that you helped edit, and the title is Under Fire: Childhood in the Shadow of War. And why is it important, or what is the reason you feel this book needs to be brought to people's attention? Under Fire: Childhood in the Shadow of War.
Well, actually, the book was conceived from a conference at Princeton using the Kotzen collection of rare books, and it's about representations of war for children. And so it really began through that literary lens. But if you think about it, I think all children are living with increased amounts of fear and a sense of the terrorism that we all are sort of drinking from the news media. And so in a real sense, I think all children are under fire, and they aren't living lives free from fear. This is the Declaration of the Rights of the Child had envisioned that this is actually a very important issue for children, to live free from fear. So the book became much more eclectic, and in the introduction and in the people that are included, we deal with some real-time issues and the ways in which our understanding of trauma has been deeply nuanced by the recent research and events.
One of the quotes in the introduction from your book, Under Fire: the reality of growing up in societies disrupted by a kind of warfare where the notions of separation between combatants and civilians, between front lines and peaceful zones of support, have been so subverted that international law regulates them with intermittent success, end quote. And as we witness right now, in real time, the bombardment, the siege, the illegal occupation, the normalization of degradation and horror in Israel-Palestine. I've read a news item recently in which a mother, a Palestinian mother, the quote was, "My children are wetting the bed. They cry when they hear planes." That's a quote from a Palestinian mother in a recent news article. What are we to do? In my mind, I want to live in a civilization that, you know, it would never happen that we would, as a world community, permit this level of degradation and horror, simply from the standpoint that children have to have a right to live free from that level of degradation. Before we move to your other work, what might you offer in terms of the culture and the lived awareness that maybe that literature can provide in helping us move to this society that so affirms the rights of children that we actually change the structure of these relationships?
Well, historically, I think children have always been subject inadvertently or in a deliberate way to horror. So this isn't new, but I'm reminded of the Beslan school occupation in Russia 4 years ago, when actually child hostages were the weapons of war, and they were really used as human shields, and they were forced to drink urine, they were exploded into the air, and I think it's very important to be clear as individuals and as societies to see what is happening. The Archbishop of Canterbury defined that 52-hour siege as the most evil kind of action we can imagine in a BBC interview. And one of the virtues, I think, of today is not just that we learn about the bad things, but that there is an opportunity for a clarity of articulation about what is really happening so that people can at least hold a discourse and think about some of these issues, such as, you know, you're providing through your program. And your question about stories, I think, is tremendously important. One of the most popular authors of this century and last, Tolkien, really has articulated what it is like to represent trauma in a series of works that really present to us, and this is discussed by Mark Heberle in the book, as what it's like to live in a world with ongoing terror and war. And I think J.R.R. Tolkien really got that in Lord of the Rings and in his great epic sweep of time, space, and history. And it really grew out of his own life in fascinating ways. And I think it's really important to understand both the popularity and the origin of that work and works like it.
So, in other words,
a world in which war is without end.
And coming to terms with the stories and the realities from a child's viewpoint, and perhaps we can move towards a civilization where this level of absolute
atrocity
is put into the past and to never rise to this level of the normalization of degradation and horror that we live with. So I guess Under Fire, Childhood in the Shadow of War, is a way to move into this zone where we're relating more to the child's viewpoint and the adult who, as Tolkien has, as you mentioned, brings that awareness to life.
That's right. The book attempts, it starts really with the Children's Crusades, with the work of Gary Dixon, and goes on to the Battle of Waterloo and the Civil War and all armed conflicts that you can think of have had stories connected to them. And this book is an effort to really analyze the importance of story in becoming human, and that the stories children are told, whether it's propagandistic, whether it's of a hopeful and survivalist nature, as Maria Tatar talks about fairy tales, these are really important food for the imagination, the spirit, and the soul. And I think, you know, we protect our children physically in the United States, perhaps way more than we need to, but the psychological development and the psychological protection is something that I think we need to bring a lot more enlightenment to.
And that takes me to your other work with the book Secret Spaces of Childhood, the film, a documentary film from Michigan Television, Where Do the Children Play?, and the companion volume to the film, A Place for Play. And Elizabeth, I'd like to let you know that what I did to bring to the air today is I made a 6-minute homeopathic version of the film. And I edited out some of the talking moments where I feel it was important to let people get a glimpse of what the film provides. But before we go to that brief little window into the film itself, where did the children play, to set up for people an appreciation of this work, can you frame your approach to this work over play and the need to understand what children are going through in the daily grind?
Well, it really grew out of my work in children's literature, where I came to understand that idyllic sites, places that children make their own, are the central drama of the most compelling works for children, whether it's The Raft in Huckleberry Finn or The Secret Garden or The Barn in Charlotte's Web, even Neverland. I mean, these are sites that are unforgettable, that capture us early in life, and more important than what happens to the individuals, they are tremendously resonant. And so as I became more convinced that this story of these places had to be recognized collectively, and I began to ask artists and writers and children about spaces that were secret and that mattered to them. This was over the last maybe 10, 12 years. I became so aware of how childhood has changed, and that even the downtime and away spaces of childhood that are immortalized in these books are really becoming endangered and extinct. Hmm. And so the film really developed out of what eventuated into a book after this conference, Secret Spaces of Childhood. The film was an attempt to look at childhood today, physically, mentally, morally, spiritually, socially, in terms of the geography of where children grow up. So it's really divided, you know, rather crudely into, you know, urban, suburban, rural settings.
Let's go to the clip of the film. This is about a 6-minute clip of the film, pieces to give people a sense of what the film provides, and then we'll come back in further discussion. This is from Where Do the Children Play?, a documentary film from Michigan Television, and I am on the line with Elizabeth Goodenough, one of the developers of the film. Please listen.
For tens of thousands of years, for all of human history and prehistory, human children went outside and spent much of their lives in nature, either working or playing. And within the space of 2 or 3 decades in Western society, we're seeing the virtual end of that.
A generation or two ago, the parents were pretty much hands-off. There was not the perception that it was dangerous to be out in the streets if you were in a city. And if you were in a rural setting, you generally didn't have an automobile to take you in to practice football or volleyball or some such thing. Kids were left largely on their own in the afternoon and after school to sort of make up whatever kind of play they wanted to.
What's happening now is we have parents who think that good parenting is creating certain discrete opportunities for their children, and they're pushing them in that direction. And as a result, things like play become secondary. Not as important as an organized activity. Not as important as something that'll get you into college. Big mistake.
I think there's a great cost to children's inability to have a kind of private life in nature, and to explore and adventure on their own or with their peers, and to enjoy that with freedom.
My feeling is that play is so deeply rooted in all of us as humans, in our species, that we have to pay due attention to it, and we have to allow those experiences to come out in children's play.
When play is child-driven, when kids figure out what they want to do, when they're on their own playground or out in the backyards or on the streets themselves, they're learning what they like. They're learning what they're not so good at. They're learning what they're great at. They're learning to get up when they fall down, and they're learning to take chances. They're learning peer negotiation skills. These are all incredibly incredibly important traits to bring them into adulthood.
I guess I can get these leaves to absorb it.
I'm very concerned with, I'd say, the lack of innovativeness and imaginativeness in high-performing leadership kids who are now getting high SATs and have a resume that looks like a Wall Street senior vice president by the time they get into college, because those kids seem to me to have been programmed to please adults and to have systematically suppressed most any of their deeply innate talents that I think are revealed often through spontaneous play.
We need parents to redefine success. If success in this generation is being defined as getting a fat envelope from a particular college, then we're going to produce kids who are scared to fail. We're going to produce kids who are highly regimented in many different activities, who are doing precisely what adults tell them to do. Why? To please adults. If that happens, we are going to lose the major thing that is going to lead our next generation, which is creativity and innovation.
I feel that a democracy requires that people think on their own. And if we can't think on our own, they have our own ideas when we're children, I don't see at what point we develop the capacity for forming our own ideas. We become very good at following instructions. My concern is, if children stop playing, if we stop having ideas of our own, and then, if heavens forbid, something happens and our country or another country slips into totalitarianism, where are the citizens who know how to think, to have their own ideas, their own creative experiences, who will really fight off the totalitarianism? That's what I'm concerned about. I love Albert Einstein for many reasons, and he had great statements, and one of them was, you cannot solve problems with the same thinking that created those problems.
I think it's also important for health professionals to be saying to parents, you know, just let the children play. Now go out and sit and watch. They'll be fine. Just trust to it.
Children come to teach us what we need to learn to survive as human beings. And that process is often very painful because as adults we don't like to be that unsettled and to have to learn from people we're also trying to guide and discipline and protect and do all these other things with.
Sometimes generations reverse their patterns, and that's what I'm hoping will happen here. By talking about play, by sharing play, by activating play, these young people will begin to see what they missed, and they'll make sure that their children have it, because they'll see how vital it is. My own experience is it's not hard to bring children back to play, but with some children you really need to intervene and work to bring them back, because they've lost it for one reason or another, and they don't seem able to find it again on their own.
You are tuned to WBAI New York, and that was an excerpt from Where Do the Children Play?, a documentary film from Michigan Television. I am on the line with Elizabeth Goodenough, one of the developers of the film. Elizabeth, before our break in about 5 minutes, one of your messages in that excerpt was that we don't have, it's more than play. I'm understanding from your work, it's more than play. It's a sense of children having their, not only privacy is important, but the capacity and the freedom to exercise their own personhood. So to me, this goes beyond play. Would you like to bring your thoughts into that perspective?
You know, you've said it really well. Freedom, I'm so glad you said that word, privacy. And I'd add the word participation in terms of learning with and from children and not scripting every aspect of their growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely love this collage of sound you've created. I never imagined that this could be on the radio, and it was very powerful. And I loved hearing Richard Louv, who says later in the film, what we really need is a Leave No Child Inside movement. Mm-hmm. And, of course, since the film was made a year ago, that has burgeoned, not just in every state, but you can go to the Children in Nature Network and see it. So I feel that we have, just as Joan Allman said, quoting Einstein, you can't solve problems with the same kind of thinking that created the problem. We can't solve these problems alone. It's tremendously important to have conversations like you and I are having and like everyone can have anywhere on Earth about these issues that touch not just the present, but will determine our future. Mm. And I loved hearing Stuart Brown, the founder of the National Institute for Play, talk mm-hmm. about the lack of innovativeness in higher education and in business. I mean, at Stanford now, in the School of Architecture, they have students playing with Erector sets and Legos because they didn't play with that as kids.
Oh, my gosh.
And you need to have that kind of hands-on experience. And at the University of Iowa, at the School of Engineering, it's the kids who've grown up on a farm, who've worked on tractors, who've worked with their hands that become the best engineers. And I think we're really taking that kind of experience away, of working on things with your hands. And when you brought up the word privacy, I mean, this is, of course, the bedrock of secret spaces of childhood. And one of my fears is that, you know, if all adults get on the bandwagon, which, is, of course, is my dream, that people support play, that mm-hmm. they will co-opt mm-hmm. play, they'll colonize play, they will think, oh, yes, now play is the thing, as Shakespeare said, and really turn it into their thing, when really it is about something much more ineffable that has to erupt from the inside of each individual to become that person. And that's really what Secret Spaces of Childhood was about, was plumbing these private worlds that, as adults, individuals saw a nascent self and a kind of activity or being and world building that felt right for them. And so often, well, almost, I mean, we could do the statistics on it, but these were outside spaces. On the cover of the book, actually, is a tree with a boy handing a girl an apple, throwing it down to her, and it's a kind of kitsch rendering of an idyllic outdoor scene. But the words of Mark Nielsen, who sort of worked on this original scene with his own add-ons, recalled his experience of hiding inside a tree, the cave of this empty tree. Have you done that, David? Have you ever gone inside a tree, not just climbed a tree?
I may have never found a tree with that capacity. Certainly, I've been very close to trees and when I could in my former lives in nature. And yes, it's something that will please continue your thoughts. Yes, and we'll need to break in about 30 seconds.
Well, he gets inside the beast's absent core, he calls it, with a girl, and they hear each other breathing, and they think about a time before time, and it's a very rich moment when everything seems just right, like the seeds at the core of an apple. It's an absolutely beautiful verbal expression by this artist of what an identification with a living thing means.
Hmm.
When you know that its elements are part of your elements. And this is not special effects wonder. This is the true immersion.
Yes, where nature, in your words, nature becomes the source of imaginative growth and understanding in childhood, where it becomes vital in the origin of the self, quoting from you. And I am on the line with Elizabeth Goodenough. My name is Dave Occhiuto. This is a program entitled The Nature of Childhood, The Rights of the Child, misunderstanding, as we are, the nature of childhood so regularly, misunderstanding, so regularly dismissive of a positive agenda for the rights of the child, and derelict in our duty to develop a culture of obligations towards childhood. We are trying to address these issues. Thank you for your listening ear, and I will return in a moment with Elizabeth Goodenough. Please stay tuned.
children. This is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener-sponsored, children. It's commercial-free. Ooh, change-a-looyah.
Folks, I'd like to just mention a couple of things happening that we should be aware of. On January 6th of the new year, 2009, January 6th will be the opening of the 111th Congress in Washington, D.C., and there will be a March of the Dead. The March of the Dead will be there to carry the names of those killed during the illegal U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, to demand that Congress end the terror of war. To demand that Congress end the terror of war. To make it a presence on Capitol Hill that cannot be ignored, come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th, 2009. For more information, go to peacenowar.net. That's PEACENOWAR.net. Or go to arrest, or you can email arrestbush@gmail.com. That's arrestbush@gmail.com. The March of the Dead, January 6th. And also, please go to mathisresist.us. Mathis Chereau is the U.S. Army resistor. He has refused to deploy to Iraq, and the Army has alleged that his misconduct needs to be reprimanded, but he has said that soldiers have the right and the obligation to resist illegal war. He has taken this stand in the effort to show that his refusal to participate is not a crime, but resistance to official criminality and crime. Go to Mathis Resist. .us, MathisResists .us. You are tuned to WBAI New York, and you are listening to a Navajo social dance, part of a ceremony to help release negative forces from the patient who may be either physically, spiritually, or mentally ill. A Navajo dance, Jones Benelli performing on the Tribal Gatherings disc, Native American Intertribal Music. Tune to WBAI New York, WBAI.org on the web. My name is Dave Occhiuto, on the line with Elizabeth Goodenough, a child studies scholar and activist. Elizabeth, in the book A Place for Play, the companion volume to the film Where Do the Children Play, it's a fantastic arrangement and compilation of all these voices. But from your introduction, I'd just like to read a moment from your introduction, quote, we are at the stage, understanding how children themselves have become our last frontier. Their bodies, minds, and spirits are now contested ground in our changing global order. Choices made by planning and school boards, parks and corporations, families and legislators today will determine how the next generation envisions the future and reshapes the earth. That quote I just highlighted for myself, and I go back to it frequently as an affirmation of duty and honor. Elizabeth, can you please elaborate for us your sense of the importance of tuning into this work around play and child's dignity of personhood?
You know, I love your use of the word honor and dignity, and it goes so well with that Navajo music we were just listening to, essential to tribal societies. And it makes me think about how important it has been in traditional societies to have these ritualized moments of maturation, and how impoverished as a culture we are in doing that. I mean, it may be the driver's license, the drinking age, the voting, but I'm talking about a very communal and rich sensory event. There are religious events. The bar mitzvah, the bat mitzvah are honored today, and in other religious traditions. But as a society as a whole, I think generally we're quite impoverished with children and the whole process of growing up. And I'm thinking, too, about how in tribal societies, fire and sharp implements are two elements that are very important and have really been excluded from childhood today. We don't really allow children to play in the woods, even though all of us no doubt have memories of lighting fires and peeling wooden skewers with a sharp knife and toasting marshmallows over hot embers. I mean, these are really the primal moments of, I think, our generation's sense of community around a campfire. And one of the purposes of making Where Do the Children Play was to create a 55-minute campfire moment for communities to mull over the glory and really ineffable experience of a child outdoors and what it means to explore and to have that freedom and privacy. And I guess, you know, we can then turn to the fact that recess and time outdoors in school is being, if not limited, greatly reduced. It's treated almost like a privilege and not a right, that if you do something wrong, you're punished by being kept inside, or it's being reduced because there are more important things to learn in a more, quote-unquote, disciplined and formal setting. The disciplines are held up as, you know, really the primary goal here, even now in preschools. So I really think the words privacy and freedom and the honor of bestowing on children our best memories of our own experiences and stories are just so important. And not to let them get taken away by, you know, computer games and things that really have no special meaning within a family. I'm so glad you played that music, because I think tribal societies are deep within our gene pool.
Yes, yes.
And we think, you know, as Richard Louv said, you know, things have changed very rapidly, and that we may be suffering from attention deficit or nature deficit disorder.
Yes, exactly. And but this is what your work has helped me understand. Nature deficit disorder, something to contend with. Privacy deficit disorder. Dignity of personhood deficit disorder. And village deficit disorder. What I found so fascinating in the film is that the city kids were actually healthier than the suburban kids. Could you describe your
reaction? The film makes, I would say, a case for that. You know, it would be great to have it contested. And, you know, the film is a 55-minute, therefore somewhat reductive,
yes,
hopefully provocative,
yes,
moment for people to consider lots of different issues, all the different issues that Kenneth Ginsberg talks about is the way childhood has been attacked. And, I mean, even the excerpts that you played really only skim off a few of them.
Of course, yes.
So, yeah, it's packed with questions and provocations. And
This issue of the neighborhood itself as provide, it's not simply nature, it's the conviviality of village life that children are missing. And in some of these city neighborhoods that are not terribly impoverished, that have some decent community value and community equity, there should be a lot more, but there's some, the children have a fuller imagination. Can you describe that?
Well, the most commented upon segment of the film, or at least one of the most, is the research study by Claire Gallagher that compares city and suburban children. And she asked them to make these floor plans with objects about where they live. And she came to the conclusion that really the city kids had a much more participatory and negotiating style way of proceeding, whereas the suburban kids, the only public space they built together was the mall. And there were no ways to enter the mall. It was very much about the advertisements and the surfaces, whereas the lived and more textured experience of the city model showed that there was a deeper connection with neighborhood and community among the city children. And certainly the walk-to-school programs, as in Detroit, that have worked, verify that. There's another story about walk-to-school programs in the film. And the suburban children are thought to be bored by walking to school, what one of the lines in the film said. So, you know, the idea that it takes a child to make the village whole is very powerfully, I think, exemplified through the film, that the children bring us together. They break down stranger danger, because children in cities, if they are not living in zones of poverty, may have a greater opportunity. Obviously, this is a gross overgeneralization.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But there are books like Hidden New York, for example, which talk about pocket parks and secret places that are public in New York City and in Brooklyn, which enable community events to occur. And, I mean, this is a fabulous resource that, you know, I highly recommend, Hidden New York. And I want to say one of the things that disturbs me very much is the use of the surveillance camera in public high schools today.
Yes.
In Ann Arbor, we have at Pioneer High School $97,000 that was just spent on a surveillance camera model, even though the students banded together last year, and I don't know, I think there were over 1,000 signatures of students saying they didn't really want this, and that they were willing to work in groups and with the teachers to try and cut down on the reasons, presumed reasons for this that had to do with theft, you know, of iPods and things like that. So, you know, it's a way in which I think our own schools are being turned into the factory prison model, and the spaces, even in our public schools, are losing that sense of privacy and community and relationship. I think that's a very, very disturbing thing that's happening right now. I have to tell you another thing that just happened to me yesterday as an anecdote. I was crossing the Blue Water Bridge from Ontario to Michigan and noticing, since we were in a traffic jam on the top of the bridge, how glorious the, you know, 4 o'clock sun was falling on the small, almost miniature houses below, their geometric shapes, with, you know, the wind rifling through the flags. And I always remember as a child crossing the bridge, what an amazing experience that was. You're sort of suspended between two countries. And of course, it was partly day, partly evening. It was, you know, 2008, 2009. I mean, I suppose if I really went on with this, I could see this as a cosmic moment of suspense. But I really, I realized how children are so immensely sensitive to space. And, you know, as drivers, we're like, oh my God, a traffic jam. The bridge is backed up.
Yeah, yeah.
This is terrible. And when we got to the other side, you know, our first stop was the restroom. And my son went into the men's room and he heard a very disturbing exchange in the stall next to him, which was a father saying to a, I don't know, maybe four-year-old boy, because I saw him coming out crying, pee! Pee! You broke water, you have to pee! And, you know, the way in which we treat children, I mean, I think we can all relate to this as extensions of ourselves, our own bodies, or as even, you know, mechanistic beings, like machines that need to be operating effectively or to our satisfaction, is something to think about.
Well, you know, this brings me to a point, and I let's take a moment here, because in reality, we have to admit that the majority of babies born are not intended by either biological parent. Fewer are the result of a commitment by two parents to bring a being into the world. Essentially, children occur substantially as a happenstance, a byproduct of casual or conditioned sexual activity. And how do you communicate to parents the importance of treating the child with a respect of personhood? Because you could destroy the spirit of a child in a flash. Could you comment on that?
Well, it really comes down to the fact that parenting is like being reborn. I mean, no one puts it exactly that way. They're not books about the first 5 minutes, the first 5 months, the first 5 years of being a parent, although there are those kinds of books about children.
Hmm.
So I see parenting as an enormous growth opportunity, which, as I said in the film, is not always easy or comfortable, because children really take us out of our comfort zone. And yet at the same time, they open the possibility for us to enjoy ourselves, to slow down, to become more attuned to what is going on around us, to nature itself, to take us back to the gardens and the play spaces of our own childhood, the spaces perhaps that seem magical or special, whether they were indoors or out. And, I mean, that's really how I came to the Secret Spaces of Childhood Project, was I started teaching children's literature because I had children, and then I went to spaces outdoors that I let them play in, and then doing that I began to understand this tremendous pull that adults have between the computer, the stimulation of the electronic world, and the much slower pace of children's own unfolding apprehensions. And so, you know, when you say how is the alchemy of parenthood emerging, you know, it has to happen in a natural and organic way. We can't just...
Oh, Errol, did we have a...
But to help them understand that they're feeling good, that their mood, that their capacity to walk outside at night and maybe lie under the stars and marvel at them is not just a freedom, but it's a joy that's, you know, like Thoreau said, surely joy is the condition of life. But he had to move to Walden to get closer to that.
Yes, and the importance of, and this is speaking to children out there who may be listening, of helping young people to understand that fulfillment does not come from mindlessly or even wantonly bringing children into the world, that the unfolding that each person has to bring to their own maturity before they could bring a child into the world. And you have a way of teaching us about this process of creating a self, that we're all living in childhood deficit disorder, and the importance of healing before we continually populate the earth. I find your work so healing to this understanding of forging the self.
Well, David, you've just coined childhood deficit disorder, and I really love that. And I think, you know, one thing that all adults can do, whether they have children, grandchildren, or no children, is to think about how to address this issue of safety outdoors. It's one of the reasons I'm glad Penny Wilson, the international play worker from England, who
yes.
spoke about that, was part of your excerpt from the film, because the playwork movement in London, I mean in England and other parts of Europe, is terribly important, whether we call them play rangers, play workers, but these are adults who are committed to the notion that children have a right to be outside and to have their play be unadulterated. In other words, it's not scripted, directed by adults, it is allowed, and the play worker, and there's a wonderful several articles actually about that in the book, are simply standing by, much the way in the Walk to School movement, particularly in Detroit, for example, where many people would think, oh my gosh, it's very unsafe for children to be walking to school. Adults of every age can situate themselves on corners and create a sort of breadcrumb trail of safety, And, you know, the astonishing thing about this, and this too is in the book, is how the children walking to school have become aware of eyesores and toxic sites in their neighborhood.
Exactly.
They've banded together. They've addressed the administration of the city about these. They've drawn public attention to it. And this is really how growing up in cities should happen. Louise Chawla has another wonderful article with David Driscoll in the book about participatory democracy, where, you know, children tell us what we need to learn about our cities if we let them out.
And this is where the environmental justice movement and the children's dignity and rights movement come together, because if we're going to have children enjoy their natural endowment, we have to roll back sprawl. We have to recreate landscapes that are embracing to life, and the children's rights movement, environmental justice movement, come together so beautifully. We're running out of time, Elizabeth. Can you quickly describe what you envision for people, to how they can use the film and get in touch with you to use this film not simply to entertain but to ignite and to create social life?
Well, anyone who would like to see the film, the Alliance for Childhood has made available free films for group showings. And as outreach director, I'm very, very happy. My email is lizgoodie@umich.edu.
Can you spell that?
It's lizgoode@umich.edu.
Okay.
And I'd be very happy to talk with anyone who would like to have an informal showing, or, you know, something at their public library, wherever they have a way to show this, about how to make their best kind of event, because there are individuals both in the film and in the books that perhaps could attend the showing, talk at the showing. There are lots and lots of ways to make this campaign of awareness spread.
Yes, and the DVD, you can call 1-800-343-4499, 1-800-343-4499. MichiganTelevision.org/children play. MichiganTelevision.org/children play. Elizabeth Goodenough, thank you so much for joining me today. And 10-15 seconds of a last word.
I just wanted to say there's a 30-second teaser of the film on the website you just gave, and an essay and images which are available for anyone who would like to lift them and use them in their communities. This was my hope when I started this project, so I'm thrilled, and thank you so much, David, for asking me to talk on your program.
Thank you so much for being there. We will be in touch. Folks, we have to go. I'm at davido@wbai.org. Bye-bye, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
President-elect Obama is to say something, please, about the humanitarian crisis that it's being experienced right now by the people of Gaza. I would like to ask my former colleagues in the United States Congress to stop sending weapons of mass destruction around the world, as we are about to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Let us remember what he said. He said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet. And guess what? We experienced a little bit of that violence, because the weapons that are being used by Israel are weapons that have been supplied
well,
by the United States government.
The people review what's taken place in the last 6 months. They're all in one package.
It is a big monster with stress on the full innocence of people.
Yo. I only ask of God. He won't let me be indifferent to the injustice.
No.
That they do not slap my other cheek after a claw has scratched my whole body.
Baby.
Well, folks, I'll see you next year here on WBAI. Michael G. Askins will be coming in a moment to continue out the day. This is Peace and Justice Radio in New York. Now, Merrill Maitland, I think.
It is a big monster with stress on the poor innocence of people.
Yeah, put your lights up for all my people.
President-elect Obama is to say something, please, about the humanitarian crisis that is being experienced right now by the people of Gaza. I would like to ask my former colleagues in the United States Congress to stop sending weapons of mass destruction around the world, as we are about to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Let us remember what he said. He said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet. And guess what? We experienced a little bit of that violence because the weapons that are being used by Israel are weapons that have been supplied by the United States government.
It's 2008.
There are no shortcuts.
Are you kidding me?
Fire department came to our door and said, you better get out now.
And when people review what's taken place in the last 6 months, and put it all in one pack.
One pack is it?
They'll realize how significantly we have moved.
Really?
With the cracking and the thumps and it hit my car.
Oh, my God.
The carnage left more than 170 people.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.